Right, is that working? Good. Thanks, Lucien. Yes, this is a change from my original title, An Abstract, which I advertised in the program. Actually, that title pretty much corresponds to just one of these no-go theorems, because originally I was just going to give one of the standard talks here and then somehow got bumped up to a colloquium slot, so with the extra time I decided to put another one in. So, as it says, two no-go theorems for hidden variable interpretations of quantum theory. Both of them relate, in some sense, to this vague question which is written up here. Is the quantum state a real thing? So, by way of introduction, let's consider the following. Very simple thing. Consider n classical systems, each of which has only two distinct states. So they could just be, pointers or something that can either be up or down. Abstractly, we can just think of these as n classical bits. So I'm representing these two states just with an up arrow and a down arrow. And then if I have n of these things, here's an example of a joint state, n systems, with every single one of them either in its up state or its down state. Now, in some situations where I'm thinking about these systems, I might actually not know for sure what is the actual joint state of these n systems. And in that case, I might describe them using a probability distribution, where this is now a probability distribution over all of the joint states, 2 to the n of them altogether. So here it is, and this distribution involves 2 to the n probabilities. Okay. Now, my point here is that this classical probability distribution is a very complicated object because it requires 2 to the n minus 1 real parameters for its specification. Minus 1 just because the whole thing's normalized. But this does not in any sense trouble us, because there's no sense in which this probability distribution is a real thing. It's not some sort of physical wave that's out there sort of wobbling about. Of course, people do argue about what probability distributions really are, and I have my views, but I shan't sort of trouble to express them now. Let's just say that depending on one's stance, it corresponds perhaps to an infinite ensemble of sets of n systems, or perhaps to the beliefs of an ideally rational agent. And in either case, we can accept the fact that this is a very complicated object mathematically, because if you have an infinite ensemble, not surprising, you need a complicated object to describe such a thing. If your agent is ideally rational, not surprising, you need a complicated object to describe his beliefs. But the real thing, the ontology here, is very simple, and a specification of the underlying state of the system does not even require one real parameter. It just needs a linear number of classical bits. So, what about the quantum case? Well, consider now n two-level quantum systems, which abstractly are n qubits. In this case, the number of real parameters required to specify a pure or mixed quantum state, as we know, is exponential in n, exponential in the number of systems. For a pure state, it comes out as, well, for a d-dimensional system, it's 2d minus 2, and here d is 2 to the n, so that's 2 times 2 to the n minus 2. Minus 2 because it's normalized and there's a global phase that's irrelevant. For a mixed state, it's d squared minus 1, which when d is 2 to the n comes out like this. Now, given this, and given that all the experiments we've ever done confirm quantum theory, does this mean that the universe itself is in some sense exponentially complicated? Well, the answer is not obvious, because it might depend on how we interpret the quantum state. if the quantum state is a real thing, or if I was being pedantic, I might say, if it's a mathematical object in one-to-one correspondence to the physical state of a real thing, then, in some sense, the universe is exponentially complicated. And this is indeed the case in the Everett and de Broglie-Bohm theories, which do take the quantum state to be a real thing. In Everett, this isn't really surprising. According to this interpretation, the universe is literally composed of this exponential branching structure of semi-autonomous classical worlds. Not surprisingly, you need a complicated mathematical object to describe everything that's going on in all of those worlds. But a similar thing is the case in Bohm theory. We have these particles with their positions, but they need the quantum state to be a real thing because it pushes the particles around. It tells them where to go. And all of that complexity that's in there in the Everett description, in the Everett universe, is also there in the Bohm universe. Even if the Bohmian sort of refuses literally to admit this as a collection of distinct worlds. Okay, but there is another possibility. Of course, perhaps the quantum state isn't a real thing in that way. Perhaps it's more like the probability distribution in the classical analog that we started with, in which case the exponential complexity of it wouldn't trouble us. And maybe even there could be an underlying reality which is simple in nature. So this idea, the idea that the quantum state is best understood as an analog of a classical probability distribution, that is, as encoding information about reality rather than describing reality directly, is roughly speaking the epistemic interpretation of the quantum state. Later on, I'll make some more precise definitions and distinctions. Now, one motivation, one reason why you might have this point of view has just been described. If we think that an exponentially complicated universe is somehow a priori implausible, then an interpretation of quantum theory with an underlying simple ontology would be very attractive. But there are other motivations too. One of them is this one. When we see collapse of the quantum state on measurement, that has very much a feel which is more like updating a probability distribution than it does a real dynamical process. And even more so when this collapse is happening at a distance. Another motivation one might mention is this toy theory of Rob Speckens, which is a simple model involving an ontic state, a real state, and a sort of constraint that means you can't know everything about the real state, and which reproduces this long list of quantum phenomena which gain a very simple and direct explanation in the context of this model. And Speckens takes this to be evidence that we should take a similar approach, i.e. an epistemic interpretation towards the quantum state. All right, so in a moment I'll start talking about the first of these no-go theorems. But before getting started, let's be a bit more precise. So I'm going to say what I mean by an ontic model for quantum theory. Suppose that there is some underlying reality. This is given a quantum system. The underlying reality corresponds to some hidden state or ontic state. I'll use these two terms pretty much interchangeably. And secondly, the pure quantum state corresponds to a distribution over ontic states. So the idea is that if I do some preparation of the system where I'm preparing the system in some pure quantum state, what I'm actually doing is preparing it in one ontic state or another ontic state, with these being drawn according to some distribution. And then for a particular quantum system S, what I'll call an ontic model defines a space, big lambda, of possible ontic states. For each quantum pure state psi, a probability distribution, mu psi, over big lambda. And for each hidden state, little lambda, which is an element of big lambda. And measurement M and outcome K a response function, xi sub km 1 big lambda, such that this function is the probability of getting outcome k when I did measurement m and the ontic state was lambda. So when I prepare a system, I prepare a distribution over ontic states, and then given a particular ontic state, it defines probabilities for measurement outcomes. And we'll say that this model reproduces the quantum predictions if the probabilities match. So on the right-hand side, these are the probabilities according to the ontic model. Given outcome k, measurement m, we integrate over all lambda, probability given to lambda, probability of the outcome given lambda. And on the left-hand side is the quantum probability, where psi is our pure state and EKM is the positive operator corresponding to outcome k of this measurement m. Good, okay, so with all that out the way, part one on the exponential character of the ontic state. This is joint work with Nicola Brunner, Argalego, C. Gogolin, at least two of whom I've seen around at this conference. So to begin with, here's a question then, given all that I've said already. Given n quantum systems, is there an ontic model such that an ontic state in this model can I be identified with only a linear number of classical bits, with the quantum joint state of these systems then being a distribution over these classical bits? Well, the answer is no. It would have been nice if it was. If so, this ontic model would have been very similar to the classical analog I began with. The quantum state would be complicated in the way that the classical probability distribution is, but the ontology would be a very simple thing. And given the ontological extravagance of the Everett and Bohm theories that I described, actually the existence of such a simple model, I think, would potentially be a powerful argument against Everett and Bohm. But the answer is no, as it says. We know this from a theorem of Lucien Hardy, which he calls the ontological excess baggage theorem. And this states that for an ontic model to reproduce the predictions, even of just a single qubit, then the cardinality of big lambda, of the set of ontic states, must be infinite. The proof of this is quite simple. I'm not going to do it now just for reasons of time. But it's quite nice and not very difficult. But what does this tell us? It tells us that the quantum case of n qubits is not at all like the classical case of n bits and a probability distribution over n bits. Indeed, forget about scaling as the number of systems increases. Even for a single qubit, the number of hidden states needs to be infinite. So, now what? What do we do with that? Well, here's another question that, having taken that on board, we might ask. Instead of counting the number of hidden states, or equivalently, the number of classical bits required to identify a state, suppose we assume a continuum of hidden states and count the number of real parameters required to identify one. Then we can see if that increases exponentially as the number of systems grows. Now, we're going to have to make a couple of sort of extra auxiliary assumptions here if we want to be counting real parameters. After all, real numbers can always be merged into one just by interlacing the digits, for example. So we'll need to assume something like this. Let the space big lambda have some suitable structure, perhaps a differential manifold. Let some suitable continuity conditions hold, perhaps something like this. Nearby hit states on that manifold make similar predictions for measurement outcomes. And does there then exist an ontic model for n quantum systems such that the number of real parameters required to identify a hidden state is linear or polynomial or at least sub-exponential in n? Now, this question was raised by Alberto Montina from Perimeter Institute in this paper here, and in also in a number of other papers. As far as I know, the answer is unknown. Alberto has proved a few interesting things. So, in one paper, he does show that the number of real parameters grows exponentially, but he needs to consider the dynamics of the underlying ontic state and make some assumptions about Markovianity and things. So it's not a proof that goes straightforwardly just from the statistics of preparations and measurements, which is what I'm talking about. There's another sort of very nice paper where he has a model for a single qubit where the ontic state is described by only one real parameter instead of the expected two, which is a cute thing. Okay. But here's an alternative direction anyway. The thing is, this idea that you need infinite ontic states and that you might count real parameters, this only applies if we're demanding that the ontic model reproduce exactly the predictions of quantum theory. So even if we proved something, it wouldn't be something that you could really experimentally test. So here's an alternative direction, the approximate case. Suppose we only require of an ontic model, that quantum probabilities are reproduced up to a tolerance of plus minus epsilon. Well, in that case, Lucy and Hardy's result doesn't hold. In fact, if you tolerate epsilon error, then for a finite dimensional quantum system, you can always approximately reproduce quantum predictions with a finite number of ontic states. So then there's a new question for fixed epsilon. How quickly must that number of ontic states grow as the number of systems increases? So that's the thing which we have an answer for. And the way I want to phrase it is in terms of what I'll call data tables. So consider an experimental setup where we have some number of different ways of preparing a system. Let's say R different ways of preparing a system. So perhaps I just have one bit of lab equipment and I could, with a R different settings on it that I can adjust. Or maybe I just have R different devices. And similarly, I have measurement devices and there are S different measurements that can be performed. So again, either one thing with S different settings or S different bits of equipment. And each of these measurements, when I perform the measurement, there's a pointer that goes one way or another, and there are T possible outcomes altogether. And by connecting these preparation devices and measurement devices up in different ways, I can gather data and I can eventually determine the probabilities for getting a particular measurement outcome given a particular preparation. And then I can write all this data in the form of a table. So that's what this table is here. Across the top, we have the different preparations, P1, P2, and so on up to PR. Different measurements down the side, M1, M2, down to MS. Each measurement has T outcomes. And then an individual entry in the table is just the probability of getting that outcome, given that I did that measurement and that preparation. So how I want to think of this table is just first as a sort of table of raw experimental data where we don't know anything about the sort of underlying systems that we're actually preparing and measuring here. So given such a table of raw data, here's one kind of question that you can ask. Suppose we want to construct an ontic model with the specific aim of reproducing the probabilities in that table. So this is not an ontic model for all possible preparations and measurements on some quantum system anymore. It's just an ontic model for that table. It'll involve the following. There'll be some finite set of ontic states, lambda 1 up to lambda dc. You can always do it with a finite set because the table's finite. Now, each preparation here, each PI, will correspond to a probability distribution on that set. And for each hidden state, lambda, and for each measurement, mj, outcome k, The hidden state should determine the probability for that outcome. And then the condition that we reproduce the probabilities in the table is this one. Probability of outcome k given nj preparation pi is the sum over ontic states, the probability for each ontic state times the probability of that ontic state. And if we're only demanding that we reproduce this data approximately, then this equation should hold plus or minus epsilon. Now, for a particular data table, you can then ask, what is the value of DC, the classical dimension, or that is the number of different ontic states, in the most efficient model, where the most efficient is the one with the smallest number of ontic states? Well, this question was raised by Nick Harrigan and Terry Rudolph in this paper. And for a completely arbitrary data table, it may be a difficult question, but they do give some ways of calculating upper and lower bounds. Here's a different kind of question you can ask given a data table. Suppose that we want to construct a quantum model instead with the aim of reproducing the data in the table. So in this case, there'll be a Hilbert space H dimension dQ. Each preparation will correspond to a density matrix, rho I on H, each measurement to a povum on H, and the quantum predictions trace of rho E must match the entries in the table. Again, you could do this for the approximate case if you wanted to. And then you can ask for a particular data table, what is the value of the dQ, which is the dimension of that Hilbert space, in the most efficient model? Most efficient is the one with the smallest Hilbert space. This question was raised by Wiener, Christandl, Doherty in that paper. And again, for a completely arbitrary data table, it may be a difficult question, but they give a lower bound based on earlier results of Ashwin Nayak to do with quantum memory. Okay, but what's this? Where was I going with all this? This is the question which I wanted to ask. Given this idea of a data table, can we find a sequence of data tables, D1, D2, and so on, of increasing size, such that the nth table in this sequence has a quantum model with dimension n? That is to say, you can generate that data by doing preparations and measurements on n-dimensional quantum systems, or log n qubits. But also, the most efficient hidden variable or ontic model for the nth table has number of ontic states order 2 to the n. And furthermore, even if a fixed error epsilon is tolerated. That's the no-go theorem which I'm looking for that tells us that an ontic model for quantum theory needs an exponentially increasing number of ontic states. The answer to that question is yes. And we know this from a sort of small zoo of results, actually, that have been published in the area of communication complexity. I haven't listed all of them here. One is by Klartag and Redjev in this paper here. There are similar results that I could equally well have used by, I sort of forget all the names, Gavinsky at University of Waterloo, maybe Julia Kempes on some of them. I've chosen this one because it's simple to state what the actual problem is. So these guys consider the following communication complexity problem. Alice and Bob are separated. Alice gets a classical input. Bob gets a classical input. Bob has to produce an output. Now, Alice's input is actually a classical description of a d-dimensional quantum state, psi. And Bob's input is a classical description of a projective measurement on a d-dimensional quantum system. Actually, it's a degenerate projective measurement with two outcomes, each corresponding to a half space. So H1 and H2 is the half space complement to H1. And there is a promise here, which is that this state psi either lies in the half space H1 or in the half space H2, and Bob has to output which? He has to output, well, either H1 or H2. There is a trivial quantum solution to this problem, and it involves only log d qubits, which is that Alice just prepares this state and sends it to Bob, and Bob actually does this measurement and with his certainty he'll get the right outcome. What Klartek and Regev show, and this is the hard bit, is that if Alice and Bob can only send classical bits to one another, they have to send order D classical bits, which is exponential in n if this is a state of n qubits, of course. And furthermore, this holds even if approximation is allowed, which means that sometimes Bob can output the wrong answer. And furthermore, it even holds if a two-way conversation is allowed. So we can apply this. I mean, this is pretty much tailor-made for our problem. We construct data tables such that the preparations are preparations of d-dimensional quantum states, and the measurements are these two outcome projective measurements onto half spaces. And any ontic model for that data table corresponds to a strategy for the communication complexity problem. Alice simply sends to Bob a classical description of the ontic state. And what the result of Klartek and Regev shows us then is that any ontic model for such a data table must have a number of ontic states order 2 to the d. Otherwise, the corresponding strategy would solve a communication complexity problem with only a small amount of classical communication, which is impossible. But there's an extra little element here which I quite like, which is to do with the fact that their result even held for two-way classical communication. With our data tables where there's a preparation and a measurement, it means that you can't get around this no-go theorem, even if you allow some kind of weird backwards causality from the measurement device to the preparation device, which would somehow correspond to a two-way conversation in the communication complexity scenario. You still need the exponential ontic states. Okay, this is a question about which there's an interesting discussion to be had. Maybe I'll come back to it. For reasons of time, I want to come to part two, which is the other no-go theorem. Now, with that first one, I'm pretty much aware that I haven't really said anything new there, by the way. I was simply sort of appealing to some existing results by some other people. But I do genuinely think that that result is really important for foundations. And what I've found just by going around talking to people is that most people don't know about that result, especially people in foundations, because they don't often read papers on communication complexity, I guess. So my aim there was really just to sort of tell a story and present a number of different results all in one setting. This result here, on the other hand, is a new one. It's joint work with my PhD student, Matthew Pusey, who is here at the conference. And I should say, to give credit where it's due, it's pretty much his idea. I helped a bit with getting the final proof together. But the core of it really was his work. So to explain this one, this is the same slide we had before, as a quick reminder. This is what I mean by ontic models for quantum theory. Underlying hidden or ontic state. Quantum state is a distribution on ontic states. Big lambda is a set of possible ontic states. For each quantum state psi, a distribution mu psi on big lambda, a condition for reproducing the predictions. Okay, I want to say something now, just slightly more refined, about the difference between models where the quantum state is a real thing and models where it's not. So consider this picture here. This rectangle corresponds to the set of possible ontic states. So that rectangle is the set big lambda. And for any particular pure quantum state, say phi, it will define some distribution mu phi over big lambda, and that distribution will have some support where it's non-zero. So I've drawn here a possible shape which is the support of mu phi, and for a different quantum state, distribution mu psi has this support here. And you'll notice that in this picture, these two do not overlap. Well, now suppose that actually, for every pair of distinct quantum states, these two things do not overlap. Well, in that case, the quantum states that you prepared can actually be inferred from the ontic state of the system. So for any particular little lambda in here, it only lies in the support of one quantum state. So just from knowing the ontic state lambda, you can tell what quantum state the system was prepared in. So in some sense, all the information about the quantum state here is actually contained in the ontic state. And it's fair to say that in this case, the quantum state is a real thing. Even if when you write down the model, it doesn't appear explicitly. It really is there. All the information about it is there in the real state of the system. Such a model, it's useful to have a name for it. I'll call it psi ontic. On the other hand, here's a different kind of model where these two supports do overlap. So if there exists some pair of quantum states, phi and psi, whose distributions mu phi and mu psi overlap, then we'll say that the model is psi epistemic. And that means that if the ontic state lies in the overlap region, such as this lambda naught above, then it is not possible to infer from it whether the quantum state phi or psi was prepared. And as I've stated it, this is a very weak condition, by the way, because I've only said that to be psi epistemic, there must exist two quantum states with this overlap. So a sort of more reasonable and stronger condition might say that perhaps for every pair of non-orthogonal quantum states, there must be some overlap or something like that. But in order to prove the no-go theorem, I only need this weakest possible definition of what we mean by psi epistemic. And what I'm going to show you is a no-go theorem for psi epistemic models. So to begin, suppose then that there are distinct quantum states, phi and psi, whose distributions overlap like this. And suppose that there's an ontic state, lambda naught, in the overlap region. And suppose that the probability of preparing lambda naught given phi is at least q, where q is greater than 0. And similarly, the probability of lambda naught when I prepared psi is at least q. Now, what I'm giving you here is actually a simplified version of the argument. If I was doing this properly, we'd allow for a continuum onto space, and we'd be talking about distributions on that space. So it wouldn't necessarily be the case for any particular ontic state, lambda naught, that it has non-zero probability, if you see what I mean. It's just for the simple version of the argument, I'm assuming that it does. Next, let x be the mod squared of the overlap between these two states, phi and psi, and choose a positive n, which satisfies this. That, I mean, it's got to be greater than or equal to log to the base x of a third. No, never mind just yet about where that comes from. And now consider the following three joint states of two n systems. So each of these is a product state, and it can be generated with two n completely independent preparations. One of them, I'll call it chi1. It's a big product state of two n copies of the state phi. Another one, I'll call it chi2. And it's a big product of 2n copies of the other one, the state psi. And the other one, I'll call it chi3, that this is n copies of phi tensored with n copies of psi. So that's also a product state on 2n systems. Now, when, for example, the chi1 state, which was a big product of phi's, is prepared, we're going to make an assumption here, which is that the ontic state, the underlying hidden state of that big system, is actually a product of an ontic state for each individual system. And furthermore, that the distribution over ontic states that we get is the product distribution. Now, this is pretty natural, given that these two n preparations really might have nothing to do with one another. One of them might have been performed on Earth, one on Mars somewhere, and it's only much later, you know, that they actually get brought anywhere near each other. If we accept that assumption, and bearing in mind that when I prepare either phi or psi, I have some chance of getting this ontic state lambda zero, That means when I prepare 2n of them, I've got some chance of getting lambda 0 every time. In fact, given that I prepared chi 1, the probability that I have 2n copies of lambda 0 is at least q to the power 2n. And similarly, if I prepared chi 2 or chi 3, that probability is also at least q to the power 2n. But now here's a problem. You see, as long as we choose n large enough, and actually this is the condition here, as I mentioned, then these three different states, the three different product states, chi 1, chi 2, and chi 3, are what Caves, Fuchs, and Schack call incompatible state assignments in this paper here. Actually, they have a bunch of different notions of incompatible state assignments, and this corresponds to one of their notions. So more precisely, what this means is that there exists a projective measurement M with four outcomes here, Q1, 2, 3, and Q0. And this is an entangled measurement across the joint system. And it has these properties. If the state is chi 1, the quantum probability for outcome Q1 is 0. If the state's chi 2, probability of Q2 is 0. If the state's chi 3, probability of Q3 is 0. And Q0 has 0 probability on all of these states. And actually, these three outcomes, Q1, 2, and 3, they lie in the subspace spanned by chi 1, 2, and 3. And Q0, it's just the projector onto the complement subspace. So that's why it gets 0 probability on all of them. Now, here's the thing. If the quantum state prepared was chi 1, which, remember, is just a big product of phis, then, as I said, there is some non-zero probability that what we've actually prepared is an ontic state, which is just a bunch of copies of lambda 0. So if the ontic model is to recover quantum predictions, including this one, we must have that the probability of outcome Q1 when you do that measurement on that ontic state is 0. But similarly, we can argue that the probability of Q2 and Q3 and Q0, given this particular ontic state, must also be 0. Otherwise, you won't recover the quantum predictions again. Because for any of these chi's, you've got some chance of getting this ontic state. So that means that given this ontic state, there is no probability distribution over the outcomes of M that is consistent with the predictions of quantum theory. So the conclusion. If an ontic model is to reproduce the predictions of quantum theory, distinct quantum states must correspond to non-overlapping distributions over ontic states, given at least that assumption I mentioned about product preparations preparing product ontic states. Now, as I said, what I've actually presented here is a simplified version of this argument. The better proof that we have deals with the case where the ontic states are a continuum, where we can't assume probability of lambda greater than 0 for any individual lambda. And also, and this is important, the better proof deals with the approximate case where an ontic model only need reproduce the predictions of quantum theory up to epsilon. So, and that's important. So this conclusion, it's not something to do with the existence of one particular exact measurement that you could never really accomplish in a laboratory. When you deal with the approximate case, here's the theorem that we actually get. Suppose that an ontic model approximately reproduces quantum predictions with probabilities for measurement outcomes within epsilon of the quantum probabilities. And now consider two quantum states, phi and psi, with x being mod squared of their overlap. Then this inequality holds. So this relates epsilon to the trace distance d between the distributions corresponding to those two states. And n here needs to be chosen to make the proof work, so it's greater than or equal to log base x to the third. So this recovers what you might expect, you see, looking at that. This means that if we don't mind making a small error epsilon, then we can have a small overlap between the distributions corresponding to different quantum states. But as epsilon goes to zero, as the error goes to zero, those distributions must become distinct. And we see this here. If epsilon is zero, for example, this tells us that D must be one. If the trace distance between the distributions is one, that's saying they're non-overlapping. Which leads me to propose an experimental challenge for quantum states phi and psi, which are as close together as possible, establish a lower bound on the overlap of these distributions, that's as, overlap as close to zero, trace distance as close to one as possible. Okay, and that's it. So some conclusions. First of all, from the first part, we saw that in a hidden variable model that reproduces exactly the predictions of quantum theory, there must be an infinity of ontic states. But then one might ask, how many real parameters are needed to characterize an ontic state? Is it exponential in the number of systems? And we don't know the answer to this, at least not without further assumptions. Alternatively, if a hidden variable model is only required to reproduce approximately the predictions of quantum theory, it can be done with only a finite set of ontic states. But then the number of classical bits needed to identify the hidden state underlying n systems is exponential in n. That's what we got out of the communication complexity results. And then from the second part of the talk, if we can make this assumption that given n independent preparations, a joint ontic state can be thought of as a Cartesian product with a product distribution, then a genuinely epistemic interpretation of the quantum state is impossible. All information about the quantum state must be contained in there, in the ontic state. And some final sort of shouty remarks. These no-go theorems, that they're not that easy to evade, and I don't think their assumptions are all that strong. So this is actually my sort of feeling on the matter. Either something fairly radical has to give here, maybe there are too many assumptions that aren't true just built into the structure of these ontic models we're playing with, you know, whereby there is a system and it has an ontic state and you do measurements on it. Or the alternative is, according to the first thing, we just accept an exponential underlying ontology, and according to the second thing, just a real quantum state. I mean, in which case my view is that, well, if you're going to have a real quantum state, you might as well just be an Everettian about it. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Okay, questions?
Thank you. Jonathan, I was wondering about, of course, to deduce this conclusion about you assumed that not only was the state epistemic, but also that the ontology was given by a linear number of, you assumed essentially when you have an n-fold tensor product of Hilbert spaces that you have a n-fold Cartesian product of the original ontic space lambda, but we already know that that's not, in the finite case, we know that that's not true, so you assumed something that we know is not true in your derivation in the simple case, and for your better proof, of course, we don't know the answer in the case of real parameters if it grows exponentially, but essentially you're assuming that it's not clear if you're assuming that it's not growing exponentially or if that's just the way you stated the problem.
Yes, so you point out that for the second of the no-go theorem, I sort of assume this product state of ontic states, and yet for the first theorem has already told me that I can't make do with an ontic state, which is only linear in the number of systems. Good point. I think part of this is that in order to prove that first theorem, you need to consider preparations of lots of different entangled states of these n systems and lots of entangled measurements on them. And this is what gives you that the ontic state has to grow exponentially. Whereas the second theorem, we're only doing preparations of product states, although the measurement is an entangled measurement. So it's not that the theorem needs to assume that there is a sort of product ontic state for any preparation of a system, including entangled ones. It's weaker than that. It's just that you can describe the system with a product state in the special case that you have done a product preparation. So as Lucien pointed out to me, this is true, for example, in Bohm theory, where for a generic state of n systems, you might have this big entangled wave function. But if you do a product preparation, you get a state which is a product form. You know, a pure wave function along with position for each one.
So if I understand correctly, for your better proof, it deals with the continuous case. I mean, you can essentially pad the ontology with these extra exponential parameters, and your proof still goes through? Is that a correct way to understand it?
For the second...
Proof you didn't present, the one that deals with the continuous case.
Yeah.
With the continuous ontology.
Yeah.
I mean, are you assuming... Do you really have to assume that the ontology is a Cartesian product of these ontic spaces, or can you just pad the ontology with other kind of relational degrees of freedom and your proof still goes through?
I suppose it would depend on what those relational degrees of freedom are doing. The assumption would be something like they're not going to influence measurement outcomes if what you've actually done is a product preparation. You see what I mean? I mean, if you put extra degrees of freedom in there, as you suggest, and then allow them to know what the product preparation was and influence measurements, then you get around the proof.
Well, I want to draw a question a little bit. The idea that a classical probabilistic distribution over n bit strings is ontologically simple because you can think of it as a mixture over these simple things, and yet a quantum superposition of n qubit states is exponentially complicated. I think the whole lesson of quantum mechanics is that non-orthogonal states are not, certainly they're not reliably distinguishable. And I think the lesson we should learn epistemologically from that is that they are, or I should say ontologically from that, is that they are not ontologically distinct. Non-orthogonal states are not ontologically distinct. And that if we learn to think in a more quantum way, we will feel that the superposition of any number of n qubit states is scarcely more complicated than one n qubit state. Or to go in terms of your last slide, the idea that there's a big difference between the interpretations of quantum mechanics is a side effect of thinking too classically.
So, of course, given two distinct classical probability distributions, you can't, in general, rigorously distinguish between them, not with a single-shot measurement. And the same is true with two non-orthogonal quantum states. Now, at the very beginning of the talk, I could have listed that as one of my reasons for preferring an epistemic interpretation of the quantum state. I could have said, look, here's another way in which it's similar to classical probability distributions and not similar to what we usually think of as the real state of something. But then using some only rather basic assumptions, I proved some theorems that show, actually, we can't sustain that view. So you say the lesson of quantum mechanics is that...
even though it makes an exponential number of mixing things together to produce results, the fact that you can get it from a superposition, and I regard any superposition as no more complicated complicated than the things that it's proposed on.
I think I'm not entirely sure what that last statement means. Sorry, I'm trying to think back to some of your other comments. I mean, it's all very well to talk about thinking too classically and the lesson of quantum mechanics. I'm not sure what these phrases mean is the problem, unless we start trying to say something more definite and start proving theorems and things. In the classical case, there's never any mystery. We don't get confused in this way. We know what the state of n coins is, and we know what a probability distribution is, and we would never confuse the two. When we talk about quantum theory, we seem to get muddled. So what I've been trying to do is prove definite theorems that tell us what we can and can't say about the quantum state in this same regard.
I don't question any of your theorems. I'm just saying that at the beginning you said that a superposition of exponentially many terms describing n qubits is an exponentially complicated thing if it were real. But I'm saying regard that superposition as simple as any state of n qubits.
You could change basis and write it as a product or just as one state. Is this what you're saying?
Yes, I think that the criterion for ontological complexity should be a kind of an information theoretic criterion. What is its holovo capacity? If it only has n bits of holovo capacity, it's not very complicated.
Well, that's just a different definition of complicated. That tells us how many bits of classical information we can send to one another using this thing. So I don't see a reason to identify that with what I'm thinking of as ontological complexity. Well, look, this, you see, I say maybe something pretty radical has to give. Maybe that, when that something gives, that is quantum thinking. But I'm not sure we've got there yet, in a clear way, anyway.
So you were saying at the start that you wanted to work out whether it was possible to have, say, a linear representation, like an ontological state space that has either a number of ontic states or a number of real parameters that grows linearly, or perhaps polynomially. It seems that at least if you assume linearity, that's actually equivalent to assuming locality.
I see what you mean, but of course, I mean, one could have, if it weren't for these theorems, an ontic state, which is just a product, one for each system, and then allow non-local dynamics between these things. So it's not exactly the same thing as locality.
But at least in terms of, say, Bell's theorem, that's actually a state space and measurement space is kind of, it doesn't have the dynamics there, or you don't need the dynamics to get a violation of a Bell inequality. So it seems that the non-local dynamics that you would have doesn't help you in violating Bell's inequality or not violating it. Does that?
Sorry, I didn't follow that bit. Why wouldn't non-local dynamics help violate a Bell inequality?
Are you talking about non-local dynamics as in measurement dynamics? So
well, it could be. I could have some model where, you know, I measure this one here, and it, when I do that, it instantaneously changes the state of the one over there.
So that would require a measurement update rule, though, which you don't seem to have in the theory.
So the
way you seem to be talking about it is you do the preparations, and the measurements are sort of instantaneous, and there's no there's no way of talking about how the outcome of one measurement could be affected by another, because you can't actually say what the state is after a measurement.
Well, at no point here did I actually describe a sort of fully-fledged hidden variable theory of quantum mechanics with dynamics and update rules and everything that you would need. All I described was a kind of a schema of hidden variable theory, because I wanted to prove no-go theorems that would apply to all hidden variable theories, you know, given my assumptions.
Yes, you say the assumptions aren't very strong. So would you say a non-contextual assignment of probability, contextual assignment of probability distributions to quantum states, would that be something pretty radical, even if it was just a small change?
Do you mean the fact that I was assuming that pure state psi corresponds to a particular distribution?
Right.
Actually, no. I mean, I didn't kind of go into this in the talk. I skated over it. You might ask, why didn't I say that for mixed states, too? Why not say that a mixed state corresponds to a particular distribution on ontic state? And I didn't say that because we know from the work of Rob Speckens that you can't have a model where that holds. The distribution over ontic states that you get needs to depend on how you actually prepared that mixed state. So a mixed state will have different decompositions into pure states, and depending, you know, which one of those decompositions you think of, it's going to have to depend on the distribution on ontic states is going to have to depend on that. Now, as far as pure states go, okay, realistically, we can think of some completely different measuring apparatuses that happen to prepare the same pure state. And you might say, why assume that they prepare the same distribution on ontic states? After all, the different apparatuses, you know, the same. And there's no real reason, actually. Maybe they do prepare different distributions on ontic states. But if I was really trying to develop a sort of realistic physical model I believed in, I would take that into account. But just for these sort of aims of proving no-go theorems, we don't lose any generality by just assuming that the preparation of a given pure state always corresponds to the same distribution over ontic states.
More questions?
I just wanted to make three related comments on the reality of the state. The first one, just something that you could have added to your introduction, I think. I've always felt that the existence of teleportation is one of the strongest arguments against the reality of the quantum state, because in that process, you transmit a finite amount of classical information, and you manage to, if you believe the state is something real, then you manage to transmit an infinite amount of information, these finite number of real parameters that characterize the state. So that just makes it seem, that seems very unnatural. It's somewhat related to an earlier comment. So the second comment is on the status of quantum state in a history's formulation. One can argue that there it's neither ontic nor epistemic, it's really not there at all as an instantaneous state, but it's some sort of summary of the past, incomplete summary of the past needed for setting up the path integral for the future. So in that sense, maybe it questions all the assumptions that go into your proof. But notwithstanding that, it seems to me there's probably something very deep and important about what you said. And what it's telling us is that the quantum world, if there is a realistic view of it, is much more inseparable than what we thought. It's not only the kind of inseparability involved in the Bell inequalities, but it's an inseparability even at what you call the ontic level, that even when you seem to have several decoupled systems that are not in any sense interacting, nevertheless, the description of them has to be more than a set of descriptions, of individual descriptions of the isolated parts. So it's really, instead of a no-go theorem, maybe it's pointing us the direction in which we have to look for a realistic theory.
Okay, so a number of things. Good remark about teleportation. That's another thing, yet another thing, that I could have added to my list of things at the beginning that we might regard as motivations for thinking of the quantum state as more like a classical probability distribution. Because you can teleport classical probability distributions in a protocol that just sort of looks very much analogous to the quantum one. So yes, like the idea of not in general distinguishing non-orthogonal states, that's another thing in which they seem similar. But then, you know, with that motivation on board, I go and I prove some theorems, and we find that it's actually difficult to sustain the view that the quantum state is like a classical probability distribution. and then, what else did you... there are, of course, other attempts to construct realist theories that don't look anything like the kinds of ontic models that I've been constructing here. So you mentioned histories type formalisms. At one point you said that something wasn't ontic or epistemic in this, and that I didn't quite understand, because if something's not either, I don't understand what it is. But I certainly see that there could be, you know, other formalisms like histories that sort of go beyond the kind of the form of the models that I've been playing with. And an interesting thing is always going to be to see to what extent those can evade these sorts of theorems, or to what extent they're still captured by these sorts of theorems. And I haven't thought about it much yet, not with regard to histories anyway. sorry, was there maybe you said something else which I missed? Of course, if the quantum state's a real thing, then there is a radical kind of separability, that much is given. I suspect, you know, what we've sort of learning is that even if it's not a real thing, you still have to accept some kind of radical non-separability in whatever ontology you come up with. You know, that also might be part of the green thing there. I'm not sure I have much more to say about that.
One last question.
So for those people who are in the camp of thinking that, you know, quantum states look a lot more like a characterization of our knowledge than they do a description of reality, it seems to me there has been sort of a lot of evidence that something radical has to give. So, if you look at contextual hidden variable models and non-local hidden variable models, I mean, there's a sense in which they're very inelegant, and it would be much preferable to find something radical that went into the framework to give up instead. And so I sort of see this nice latest result as sort of another clue as to, you know, how are we going to find that radical thing that we need to get up, to get rid of, to make sense of the quantum state as a state of knowledge. But I guess I know in the past when I've pushed you very hard, you've kind of admitted that maybe you thought that, you know, ultimately the right interpretation involves taking the quantum state to be knowledge. Has your opinions of, you know, the merits of Everett versus some as yet undiscovered interpretation where something radical gives, have they changed in light of your research in this area? Or
no, I don't think changed. My opinion is one or the other. I prefer the radical idea. It gives us something to do, but Everett is a kind of backup, you see, which... you see, sometimes you can tell people about these sorts of theorems. You're a bit like this occasionally. And then the response is, well, yeah, but we don't really believe in this structure of ontic models you've described. There'll be something radically different. And that response, if that's all it is, it's a bit glib, just to sort of wave our arms vaguely at radical things. After all, there could be plenty of radical ways of modifying our way of thinking where the theorems would still apply. So I like better what you said just now, actually, which is that you could view all these little results, including Bell's theorem and contextuality, as clues of, you know, of what has to change. but we don't know yet.
Okay, so maybe on that optimistic note, we'll stop. Just before we thank John again, to remind you that the photograph for the conference participants is going to happen immediately after this, and it'll be outside. If you go up onto the mezzanine level, then go outside, and we'll be instructed what to do from there. Let's thank John once more.